everyone, and welcome back to the Strike and Ellicott Files, an unofficial podcast dedicated to all things Cormoran Strike and Robin Ellicott, as written by Robert Galbraith. My name is Kenz.
I'm Lindsay.
And I'm Pools.
And today we'll be continuing our reread of The Running Grave, this time covering chapters 14 through 16 of part one. Please be aware, as always, that our discussion of The Running Grave will often reference the ending of this book, as well as the rest of the books in the series.
Okay, should we just jump into our listener question?
Let's do it.
Okay, so this one is from Elizabeth on Twitter. It says, we know the characters and their habits so well. If you were to create a read-along bingo for the next book, what would it include? Some examples that she gave. Strike and Robin share crisps in a pub. Strike's stump gives him some jip. Robin receives a mild electric shock from touching Strike. I'm not actually sure what jip means. I mean, in the context, I'm guessing gives him some sort of trouble or pain, but I don't know that word.
I think so, but I don't know it either.
Yeah. I also want to be more specific. I think they'd eat salt and vinegar chips or crisps. Sorry.
Salt and vinegar crisps are very superior crisps.
They eat those a lot.
Well, they're delicious.
They are.
I like how they eat the flesh out of your mouth when you eat
them. They do that. Yeah.
I love this because I have some bingo card items.
Okay, let's hear them.
So number one, Strike and Robin drink whiskey together.
Yeah.
Number two, Strike gets stressed and eats a shocking amount of fast food.
We've all been there.
We've all been there. Mm-hmm. Number three, Robin avoids talking to her mother on the phone.
We've all been there. I'm just kidding.
They're very relatable characters, Lindsay. Number four, a very book-specific bingo. Robin dithers for ages about breaking up with Murphy, and even after she does, doesn't tell Strike about it for at least 100 pages.
Yeah, that's going to happen.
I feel like that's a safe one. Number five, Strike does something that makes us all dissolve into a puddle of messy hormones. Feels like a given. Number six, a moment of intense sexual or emotional tension is interrupted by an employee.
Oh, come on.
I just feel like it's going to happen. And then number seven, my final bingo, Strike and Robin kiss. They kiss on the mouths intentionally. On purpose to express their affection and desire for each other.
Thank you for elaborating what that would mean.
Gotta be specific with these two, you know?
Yeah. I'm kind of thinking that we might get a car ride from them, a trip.
Yeah, a road trip.
A road trip.
Extended time together.
Extended time together while it's still a little awkward.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I am anticipating that they are going to have a talk about what Strike wants. I think that Robin is going to say that she loves him too at some point.
Love it. Those are some pretty good ones.
I think there will be a murder to solve.
Well, that seems far-fetched.
I don't know about that,
seems
one.
Far-fetched.
I don't know. Yeah.
I think that there are clues that I will not see.
Okay. Well, that's like the free square at the middle. So,
It is.
Clues no one catches on to.
I mean, I'm going to put things like Rokeby on there. I'm going to put things, maybe we'll get the Ted Dementia clue. We're going to get that resolve maybe with Linda.
Yes.
Possibly
big
in this
with
book.
Linda. After Robin avoids talking to her.
Yeah, I don't know. Those are mine.
I like them.
All right. I'm going to guess, mainly because I missed it in this book, because there's so much fucking pizza in this book. And I'm like, can I please read about you having a curry or a kebab or a Chinese takeaway? Something.
Preach. OG takeaways.
I'd like to see them go on another road trip and spend some time together and have it be awkward. It's going to be fantastic.
Pat continues to be MVP.
Continues to be the MVP of the agency, employee of the year, every year.
Pat has an amazing moment that we all die for. That's a good one.
Like, I'd like to see Strike stop vaping.
Yeah, it's not actually good for you. Yeah,
it's actually quite
awful. It's actually
for
really
you.
Bad. Yeah. So cut down on the vape, Strike. We're still worried about you.
Should we read some answers that we got from some listeners on Twitter?
Yes, let's do it.
Doc Thelma, who's Louise Freeman, she says Robin is annoyed by her mother's protective efforts.
Yep.
We're on the same page.
Pat's voice is described as baritone.
Yeah.
Pat's e-cigarette is described as waggling in her mouth. Barkley makes a wisecrack.
That's a given. I love it.
This one's from Chloe. Strike eats cake.
Love it.
Strike thinks the lift needs to be fixed. Robin tells Strike what to do.
Yes, please.
That's a great one.
Yes. And he like does that. It. And he does it.
This one's from Shelly. Strike runs his hands through his hair, which doesn't move.
That seems very probable.
From A. Sarah, feeling down, Strike finds an excuse to call Robin just to hear her voice.
Yep. I could see it.
Oh, one of them from Crazy Time says Robin wears blue.
Love it. Yes.
Yeah. Midge argues. That
great.
Out.
I'd be shocked.
Good for her.
Peggy O, Strike looks for a bag of food in the backseat of the Land Rover. That's a good one.
Where are those biscuits?
These are all very accurate.
Melbourne Minerva says Strike thinks that prick Murphy. Oh, we all do.
Yep.
Oh, Zoe Song agrees with me. Robin tells Strike she loves him too.
Nice.
Although Keelan disagrees with you, Pools, says they still don't kiss.
Well, one of us is going to be right.
One of you will be right. One of you can get your bingo chips filled. Strike ignores a call from Charlotte. I don't think he's going to be getting any. If he gets any calls from Charlotte, we have a whole other book on our hands.
Seriously.
Maybe he gets a Ouija board. Maybe he gets a Ouija board, and when he realizes it's Charlotte, he's like, I'm good. Let's go.
And then let's just do one more from Virginia. She says, Robin is annoyed at Strike. I think that's fair, too.
Yes, that's a pretty good prediction.
Yeah, those are fun.
Those
Thanks
are
for
great.
That question, Elizabeth, really and excellent. Everyone who responded, because those were fun to read.
They're so good.
Okay, let's jump right into chapter 14.
So in chapter 14, Strike interviews journalist Fergus Robertson. And the epigraph for this chapter is, 9 in the second place means penetration under the bed. Priests and magicians are used in great number. And that's from hexagram 57, the gentle / penetrating wind.
Okay, so this one turned out to be a little bit more interesting than I first thought it was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
This hexagram talks about really getting in there and influencing or changing something by being on the inside. It talks about the wind being a penetrating force and slowly moving the clouds away. And that's what Robin does with the UHC. But I wanted to read the entire thing for this particular line judgment, because I think it's interesting in how it relates to Strike and Fergus Robertson. So it says, at times, one has to deal with hidden enemies, intangible influences that slink into dark corners and from this hiding affect people by suggestion. In instances like this, it is necessary to trace these things back to the most secret recesses in order to determine the nature of the influence to be dealt with. This is the task of the priest. Removing the influences is the task of the magicians. So I feel like in this instance, Strike and Robin, and also Robertson, are the ones infiltrating. They are the hidden enemies of the UHC. They're the ones who are going to bring this to light and cause the UHC to lose their power. I'm trying to think of how to split Strike and Robin and Robertson up in these two categories, right? The priests tracing things back and the magicians who remove the influence. I don't know. But it just feels like this is sort of a team effort, that Robertson is potentially a good contact and someone we can trust to have the same sense of right and wrong as Strike and Robin.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what I was going to say. You beat me to it. But yes, I see that the hidden enemies, the slinking in the shadows, the influencing people by suggestion. That's the UHC. It's very much their MO with the anonymous phone calls and wiki articles, right?
Yeah, but Robin does it too.
She does. She beats them at their own game. I would frame Strike and Robin as the priests, because they're the ones that need to investigate the nature of the evil. They're the ones that need to follow it to their source and figure out what's going on. Whereas Robertson is the magician taking this info and making it public to bring down the church in the eyes of the masses. But yeah, I totally agree about the sense of like a team effort. And what better profession than a journalist to pair with this hexagram? Because as it says, in the life of the community, it's the powerful influence of great personality that uncovers and breaks up these intrigues which shun the light of day. That's what journalists do. You know, they shine the light on this. Also, on a slightly less profound note, the fact that this one uses penetration under the bed when we have Strike think about penetrating beside the bed. No one's in their right place in the bed, if you know what I'm saying. But
I knew it was going to happen somewhere.
All right. The beginning of this chapter starts with Strike walking towards the pub and feeling pain in his leg after his rendezvous with Bijou.
Yeah. I mean, does this rule out any future wall sex with Robin? Because that's kind of a shame.
Mm-hmm. I hope not. I really hope not. I think that Robin would be worth the leg pain to him, though.
Yeah, I think that's a sacrifice he'd be willing to make. I really do.
But more seriously, I do think the slight pain being there, a sort of a nagging background noise that he can't quite stop. You know, he knows this wasn't a good idea. This is just...
It's symbolic. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not even that he doesn't like her romantically. He dislikes her.
Yes, he doesn't like her at all. He actively does not like her.
What's the line? 2.5 hours of mindless conversation for 10 minutes of frills-free sex.
Oh my gosh.
Talk frills about getting free.
Straight to the point.
Yeah, frills-free.
When it comes to Robin, I think we know that the sex is going to have all the frills. It's going to have more frills than an 80s bridal gown in full puff mode. It's going to have more frills than one of those lionfish with all the frills, you know?
All the frills, yes. All the frills. I hope we get to read about some frills.
I hope to God.
The word frills is very strange to me now.
Okay, so there's this next bit about Bijou. She looked better than she felt. Her impressive breasts, as he discovered in the bedroom, were fake. But the upside of finding her obnoxious was the total absence of guilt about his lack of response to the three texts she'd sent him since, all of which had been strewn with emojis. His oldest friend, Dave Polworth, would have called that breaking even, and Strike was inclined to agree.
Strike, if you're agreeing with the stuff Polworth says about women, I think that that might be a bad sign.
But we're all glad he didn't answer these texts, right?
Of course, we're all glad. We don't want him answering the texts, for God's sake.
So then Strike enters the Westminster Arms to meet up with Fergus Robertson. And I love the back and forth here at the beginning of the conversation, especially the references to Culpepper and Nina. Those are really fun. But I have to say, I think that I like him way more than Culpepper, though.
Yeah, I do too. Strike jokes and calls him a fearless reporter, but he really is, right? I respect a reporter who's kind of willing to risk a lot to go up against something like the UHC. So good for him.
Yeah, me too. Kudos, dude. Do you think he's going to prove useful to them in the future? Because it would be pretty helpful to have a friendly journalist they can call if they need journalism things, since Culpepper looks like he's been burned as a contact.
I think so. I think it's very likely we could see him again, yeah.
Yeah.
I also want to know how this guy knows that Strike's left with Nina. Like, how is that gossip made its way around from years ago?
Right? Seriously. Maybe every time Strike is in the news, Culpepper goes around like, hey, that's the guy who fucked my cousin.
Poor Nina. She must hate that.
That would be horrible for Nina. Every time Strike's in the news, Culpepper's like, hey, that guy who fucked you's in the news again. Oh my God. Sorry for the language, everybody. But honestly.
Oh, man.
Nina. I liked Nina. I really did.
I like how Fergus asks if he gets exclusive rights to the story if they find a body under the temple floor, because that's a bit on the nose, right? They find a lot of bodies and there is that murder pool under the floor.
Yeah. When he said that, I was absolutely ready to bet that they would, in fact, at some point be pulling bodies from under the floorboards. Mm. But as you say, murder pool counts as under the floor and the corpse field is pretty close by. So yeah,
it's pretty on the nose, I think.
Yeah.
All right. We find out from Robertson the tactics that the UHC uses to silence those who speak out against them. And notice that no guns are involved in this retaliation that we learned about.
Yeah.
I did not
notice this at all.
Yeah, I don't think any of us did.
Robertson mentions that his ex-wife was getting anonymous calls to her house after he published his piece about the UHC. And I wonder if this was a way to misdirect us into thinking that all those anonymous calls we'll see later on is the UHC and not someone on the outside or an ex-member. It's a bit misleading.
Oh, that's such a good point. And it would have definitely worked on me if I'd remembered this detail more than two pages later. It absolutely would have. I'd have been like, oh, they have come for anonymous calls.
Robertson also talks about the Wikipedia page that the UHC created for him. And this is exactly what they do to Strike, saying he abuses women and all sorts of things.
How dare they?
Robertson kind of reminds me a little of Strike and the way he says that they'll rue the day.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there is a sort of similarity between the two of them.
Yeah.
Which is another reason why I think that, we could see him being a good person to come back later.
Yeah, I agree.
Next, we hear about the beginnings of Robertson's research into the UHC.
I know that this is a bit of a rabbit hole, but I just found this so interesting. So Robertson says that he started investigating the UHC via the celebrity angle and looking into why these celebrities are joining.
Yeah, which, I mean, makes sense because that's the high profile big name issue that sells papers, right?
Yeah.
That's the perfect way into this.
Yeah, but I got curious if there were any journalists who did that for Scientology. And while I didn't specifically find any who were using that celebrity angle, I found a couple of journalists who did investigate cults and found themselves in similar situations with threats being made against them. And I thought it'd be interesting to share a couple.
Mm-hmm.
So the first one that I found is this woman named Paulette Cooper. She was one of the very first people to investigate Scientology. And she published a book in 1971 called The Scandal of Scientology. It says on Wikipedia that she endured many years of attacks from church leadership and their agents, including lawsuits, smear campaigns, overt and covert surveillance, outright threats, and even a criminal frame-up.
Yikes.
Church founder and leader L. Ron Hubbard was reportedly obsessed with her and personally plotted against her.
That's scary. Ooh. Yeah. I looked her up once you mentioned her name, and The thing that got her interested in the subject of Scientology is terrifying. Apparently, a former colleague of hers who'd been sucked into the church showed up at her apartment, spouted a bunch of crazy ass Scientology shit, and then told her God has decided to rape you.
Yeah. And that he was God.
Oh, yikes.
Hence, I am going to. Yeah.
Very, very scary. Thank God she escaped.
I know.
But yikes. Yeah. I'd have been looking into them after that too. I'd have been like, what the actual fuck?
Yeah. The second one I found is a man named Paul Morantz, who actually just, it said passed away a year ago, but this guy was an attorney and investigative journalist who successfully prosecuted a cult I had never heard of called Synanon.
Oh.
I don't know if I'm saying that correctly, but I'm assuming. Honestly, I just have to read a couple of these paragraphs from Wikipedia because the similarities to the UHC and just the overall story were very interesting. So in 1977, Morantz investigated the drug rehabilitation institution Synanon, which had a reputation as a seemingly successful program for rehabilitating drug addicts, where existing traditional hospitals had failed. Its founder, Charles Dietrich, a former alcoholic, established Synanon in 1958 as a non-medical self-help program that included the quote game, a session in which participants acted out hostilities and sought the truth about themselves while not being bound by that truth in making critical attacks on each other. I mean, what does that sound like?
Yikes. Yeah, that sounds very familiar to me.
And then it says, in 1974, Synanon declared itself a religion and centered on middle class searching for utopia rather than addiction curing. Synanon's assets, including real estate, 10 aircraft, 400 cars, trucks, and motorcycles, totaled around $33 million.
Damn.
Rules were passed mandating non-smoking, dieting, exercise program, group marriages, shaved heads, vasectomies, abortions, and exchanging mates. Approximately 200 couples changed partners. Members were trained in Sindo martial arts, with the elite placed in the Imperial Marines, who were trained to commit violence against their enemies.
Okay.
So I guess the vasectomies are different, right? They're not baby trafficking in this, but money, shaved heads, forced dieting, exchanging mates, right? All is very UHC.
It's from the creepy cult handbook.
Yeah.
Very much. Yeah.
By 1977, Morantz was warning government authorities Dietrich was mandating violence against his enemies and filing lawsuits on behalf of ex-members and victims.
Good for
Here's the strangest bit. On October 10th, 1978, Morantz was bitten by a rattlesnake, which had been placed in his mailbox by two members of Synanon. A neighbor applied a tourniquet in an attempt to save Morantz's life. Paramedics chopped off the rattlesnake's head with a shovel and discovered that its rattles had been removed so the snake could attack without warning.
Okay,
and Morantz was hospitalized for 6 days.
Okay. That is scary as fuck. That is very scary.
For
a snake. Not its fault. It's just doing what it does. But what a coincidence that we get a snake stuck through a letterbox in this book too, eh?
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
So anyways, I just thought I had to stop there because I'm sure there's so many more, but I just found those two very interesting. And there were some connections there for me that I thought
they
were great.
Are. And that thing about the journalists doing that, this has made me hope even more that we get Fergus in later books because I want to read some hard-hitting exposés.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Those are some of my favorite things. I love a hard-hitting exposé. I want them all.
These are a few of her favorite things.
Do, 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 do. White wine and glasses and hard-hitting journalism. Video games that take up 8 hours a day to play. None of that rhymed. And it did not scan. So.
I was waiting for something about Strike and
Harry's hairy ass and his forearms and eyes. And maybe even some more private parts.
Private? Oh my God.
Private? Again, none of this scans.
You needed the extra syllable in that.
Got to make it scan. Okay. I need a new profession because songwriting ain't it.
Oh, okay. Tips and Jingles is retiring.
Oh, no. Can I still do tips?
On a less thirsty note, I was going to say that I was just imagining if Robertson was the person who, when they solve Leva's murder, if he's going to be the person who's going to break that story.
Oh, I assume it'll just be news. I don't think Strike would want people writing about it. Maybe like if he needed to place things in papers for some purpose, you know, like he did with the ad in Career of Evil about finding a new girl Friday.
So Robertson mentions Dr. Zhao.
The description of Dr. Zhao here gives me big Dr. Oz vibes. Does anybody else get that?
Mm-hmm. I didn't, but I see what you mean. I had forgotten that he was a regular TV personality. So, yeah, I don't know if Dr. Oz would like that comparison.
I bet he wouldn't.
I'm sure he would not.
So next, they talk about the ex-UHC member that Robertson spoke to. And I believe we're about to find out here in just a moment that this is talking about Flora Brewster, right?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I have to say, this is all horrific. We don't have to go into the nitty-gritty details, but holy shit, half a decade of corrective rape is just heartbreaking and horrifying, just beyond words.
Yep.
It is. One thing that I find a little strange or interesting, I guess, is that Flora, she talked openly to Robertson about this, and it's not really matching up with the idea that I was getting of her when we heard about her from Prudence. Do you know what I mean? Like, it seemed like Flora had tried before to tell her story and get justice. Like, it really seems like Prudence thinks that Flora is too frail to talk.
Yeah.
But she has before.
Well, when she has before, she did attempt suicide the last time she tried to talk, which it might make a therapist hesitate to recommend further attempts. But really, honestly, I think it's that Flora just gave up on trying to get her story out there, you know, after the psychologist didn't believe her about the worst thing, after Robertson's article didn't result in anything changing. Like, if she'd lost hope that the church could ever be exposed, and if Prudence didn't understand the healing that speaking up and getting justice can bring and focused only on the danger, then I can see how we get the portrait of Flora that Prudence paints. I can see how she ended up here and why she's not healing.
Right. That's kind of the point that I think I'm thinking, is that Prudence is missing something here, because Flora was seeking this.
She was.
And Prudence is afraid of it.
That's why she needs Robin to set her straight over some delicious pasta.
Yes. Do you think this is a bit of a clue that this is who Prudence's client is when Robertson tells her she needs a therapist, when she thought the Drowned Prophet was coming for her?
I mean, if it was, we would then immediately be thrown off the scent with Robertson saying that she's still in New Zealand, as far as he knows.
Yeah, it's the as far as he knows.
So that does seem like a clue.
Okay, remind me, what does Flora mean when she told Robertson there's something you don't know?
She's talking about the death of Deirdre, I believe.
Okay.
It was the same thing she kept coming, kept coming close to telling Prudence, but backing away from. That was the worst thing that they didn't believe her about.
Okay, so next we learn about Flora's suicide attempt and then the influence of the Drowned Prophet after members have left the UHC, which is very scary.
So this suicide attempt by Flora is the exact same method that Charlotte later uses successfully. I have to imagine that that was intentional.
Yeah, it must have been. It's just like how the murder pool kills Deirdre, but then Robin survives it.
Yeah.
Deaths in water, only one survivor. Two women enter the water, only one woman leaves.
That sounds like the worst reality show ever.
From a movie.
Oh, is it?
Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. Yeah.
Okay, so next we learn more about the circumstances surrounding Margaret Cathcart Bryce's death. That's the Golden Prophet. And we see, I think this is the first time that we see kind of how they treat people who are ill, right? Like, they just kind of leave them to suffer.
Yeah, it's really twisted to not allow someone to see a doctor and die in agony, right? But in the same way that Flora's suicide attempt comes up again, we see the UHC do exactly this with Jacob and with Brian.
Yes, and
that
with
was
Brian.
Extra sad.
They have a pattern.
Strike then learns about spirit bonding.
Yeah, Shrike is very matter of fact here, but you just know that he's got a pit in his stomach. I think we all did when we read this bit.
Yeah, I think that we were all just waiting for the weird sex stuff to be revealed, because we knew it was coming. But this bit, when he says that the paper didn't want the better known members suing us for saying they were raping anyone. Can you imagine the satisfaction that Robertson is going to get when he finally gets to report on Giles Harmon raping underage girls?
Oh,
and
I
hopefully
didn't even think
being
about
arrested
that.
For it.
Yes,
I can't
please.
Wait. It's like, try to sue me now, asshole.
Yes. Justice.
Amen. Preach. I want to read the articles.
Yeah. We should write articles as reporters reporting on their crimes after they're done, because we don't get to see.
Oh, yeah. That would be so much fun.
Strike's parting words to Robertson here at the end of the chapter are perfect. So like we were all saying earlier, definitely wouldn't be mad if we saw Robertson again anytime in the remaining books, to be honest.
Yeah, I agree. The way Robertson correctly guesses that Sir Colin is Strike's client, again, it reminds me of Strike. So yeah, I think that he could be someone that might be more of an equal to him than Culpepper was.
Yeah, because Culpepper was never of the caliber.
No, or of the same sense of right and wrong.
I agree. This guy's an upgrade.
Let's go to chapter 15.
In chapter 15, Robin gets one step closer to being recruited for the UHC, and Strike and Robin both look into talking to ex-UHC members.
And the epigraph, in friendships and close relationships, an individual must make a careful choice. He surrounds himself either with good or with bad company. He cannot have both at once. And that's hexagram 17 following. So this seems really clear and straightforward, because the other thing that happens in this chapter is that Ilsa tries to warn Strike about Bijou. So I think this is a very Ilsa versus Bijou epigraph when it comes to who Strike is willing to surround himself with, whether physically or in the form of friendship over the phone. And of course, Robin is also a part of that, since he's lumping her in with Ilsa. And since his anger is mostly coming from her talking to Murphy in front of him, he's turning away from his true friendships to do something stupid with bad company. And he can't have good relationships with either of these women when he's making these kinds of decisions.
Absolutely. 100% agreed. The judgment says, if he throws himself away on unworthy friends, he loses connection with people of intellectual power who could further him in the good. So you're spot on. Also, if it came to an Ilsa versus Bijou cage match, I know who I'm betting on.
Of course.
My money's on Ilsa.
Yeah, me too.
All right. So getting into this chapter, Strike and Robin are meeting up for a debrief at the beginning. And it mentioned something about Storm Katie. Didn't we mention something about that before the book came out?
Yeah, Pools found this one. Mm-hmm. It's exciting to see it in the book, even though it wasn't used in the way you were predicting. I mean, thank God.
Like, thank we should have been getting Robin adrift in a stormy, tossing sea, clinging to the floating door of wood or something, while Strike frantically steers his boat into the storm to find her and rescue her.
God.
And instead we get Strike watching traffic cones tumbling down Charing Cross Road, which is actually pretty fun. Yeah, it's great entertainment.
I prefer this, I gotta say.
Yeah, I guess.
Do you remember when we were recording with Kurt after we first got the synopsis?
Yeah.
And I said something about, we're always worried about things that don't happen. And you were like, when does that happen? please take this down.
That was when that happened. Example. When I was talking about this stuff and you're like, I'm very worried. Yeah, I know.
Anyway, just saving that for future reference when we freak out over the synopsis of the next book.
Noted.
Which will happen.
Can't wait.
But anyway, I was a little bit excited at the start of this chapter because we're told that Pat isn't in and Strike and Robin are alone together and there's a massive storm outside. It has potential.
This is the stuff fanfic is made of. The next step on this is the electricity and the heat goes out. And
right.
We got to light some candles and find some blankets to snuggle up under to keep warm. I mean, come on. This is obvious stuff.
Right. But then they end up being both moody, which is a classic Joe move.
Classic Joe. She's just fucking with us. And we love her for it.
We do.
Next, Robin reports back on her progress getting in with the UHC, because now she's become a person that they're interested in recruiting. That's pretty big progress.
It was a little bit bold of Robin to tell the blonde woman that her friends were warning her against the UHC and there were rumors going around. I guess I was just thinking that maybe they might not want to bring people along who are looking for something potentially bad.
It read as a very authentic character beat for me, like, because it makes the character of Rowena seem more real, because there are plenty of rumors and she's making Rowena be a bit hard to get. And I assume that the church is very accustomed to dealing with skeptics and countering these negative narratives. Because, I mean, see what they do with Amandeep, for example, who goes to the cult, very, very skeptical. And he's at the end, he's like, I joined the cult.
Yeah, I guess it shows Robin's, her instincts for these things, because I would be worried, well, I don't know how they're going to react. Am I going to make the right move? Or am I going to say the right thing or the wrong thing? You know, but Robin has that kind of instinct to know
Robin
what's right.
She has that inner sense.
She then tells Strike that Becca was the speaker this time, and it describes her as polished and chirpy. You'd have thought she was a motivational speaker, pacing up and down, lots of big gestures.
And she looks American.
Well. This was interesting to me because Becca is kind of a bit of a mystery. I haven't quite figured her out yet, even after two full reads and other little reads. I guess it's not a side of her that I'm associating with the Becca that we saw at Chapman Farm. You know, she's much more scary and less chirpy.
Becca seems to me to be almost entirely veneer. She's just like, she's layers and layers of polish and image and hidden nastiness of the cult. It's like the real person inside has been erased and she's a walking, talking projection of the church, both the church's facade and the church's inner rot. You know what I mean? You can't get a grip on who she is because her real self has been completely subsumed within this church.
Yeah.
Where's the real Becca? She's not there.
Yeah, she's a difficult one for me to kind of understand.
So there's another mention of Americans here, the description of the blonde woman from the UAE. white teeth that Robin's speaking to.
Yeah, not that she's American, but that she looks.
But that she looks, yeah, because of her teeth.
I think she was speaking about Becca.
Yeah, that was about Becca. That Becca looks American and has perfect teeth.
I'd have to say, I didn't realize that we Americans had a reputation for having perfect teeth.
I'm only really familiar with the opposite stereotype, which right. I'm sure isn't true. There's this woman that I follow on TikTok who is an American lady living in England. She's Yorkshire Peach on TikTok, and I love her. Go follow her. And one of her videos was these silly questions that her American friends ask her now that she lives there. And one of them had to do with the stereotype that dental care isn't great in the UK. And her response was that that's absolutely ridiculous, that she has great dental care. But she does think that in America, we have a bigger emphasis on having perfectly straight teeth and braces being much, much more common here. So maybe that's where the perfectly straight teeth thing comes from.
I think that cosmetic dentistry, like dentistry just to fit a tooth image, is much more common in North America. But I have heard this American perfect teeth kind of thing before.
I've never heard this. Anyway, this might be a silly thing to point out, but I'll do it and you can decide. Okay. So I noticed that twice when Robin is telling Strike about this last UHC meeting, that Strike smiles as she's telling it. First, it's about the blonde woman telling Robin she's sure she's more open-minded. And the second time is when Robin is telling him how humble Noli Seymour pretended to be, right? So these are definitely both funny things, but I don't know. I kind of want to give Robin's storytelling a bit of credit here because she's doing a good job at finding the humor and the ridiculousness of this when she's telling him. And it makes me wonder if she's really trying to lighten the mood for the discussion she knows is coming. She knows he wants to talk about the spirit bonding stuff, and she's over here being charming and very good at her job and making him laugh.
I mean, it's an interesting possibility to, you know, sweeten the pudding and then take the reins and go straight into this difficult topic yourself. Good strategy. Could be the case. Also, we know she just likes making him laugh and, and likes making him think she's good at her job.
That too.
As well. So a bit of both.
So Strike and Robin finally get down to the hard stuff, which is discussing the whole quote unquote spirit bonding thing.
Yeah. First of all, I love that Robin is pointing out the term spirit bonding is a euphemism. But she does this not just because they should speak plainly about what the UHC is doing, but also just, I think, to have a very direct conversation with Strike about what she's actually risking.
Right. She's like, let's not dance around this. Yeah. You want to talk about it? We're going to talk about it.
It's also probably just pointing out how gross it is that the UHC does this, right? That's probably also
that too.
Yeah.
I was kind of surprised that Robin was so sure that they were just going to use emotional coercion and not physical.
I think I had the opposite reaction initially, because this actually reassured me at the time, because it's partially true that it's emotional, but it was naive to think that it would stay that simple. And I think Robin is being naive as well, but I did think it was going to buy her time, which I guess it does work for a while.
Yeah. I mean, it's easy enough for Robin to say that it's just emotional coercion, but actually experiencing what that coercion entails is a whole different kettle of fish. She does seem to me like she's being a bit overconfident, and she's intellectualizing the techniques that UHC uses without giving the credit of they affect you in a different way. But really, in her defense, there's no way of knowing what this is going to be like without actually experiencing it.
No, and I think she's still missing that key point of punishment.
Yes.
Because that's what it is. It's not just, I'm going to make you feel guilty because you're not, you know, reaching pure spirit or whatever, because Robin isn't going to care about that. It's, you will be punished if you don't do this. That's what Robin is naive to. That's what she doesn't know.
Yeah, she doesn't know about the box.
It's one of the ways in which they're very unprepared going in.
So we've talked about Strike testing Robin's commitment to Murphy, and there's a little bit of that here, I think, when he asks her about what Murphy would think about the whole going undercover, spirit bonding, that whole thing.
I think what he's actually doing here is not testing her commitment to him. He does do that earlier, right? We know that he does that earlier. But here, I think he's rightfully very worried about this and kind of looking for any ally he can get.
Even if it's fucking Murphy.
It definitely wasn't the right thing to say, because Robin's clearly offended by the suggestion that Murphy would ever get a say in this choice.
Yeah.
Did he do this with Matthew though too? He asked, what does Matthew think about?
Suddenly, when he's arguing with Robin,
right,
what then her shitty boyfriend says matters. But that's the only time. He calls it a strategic error. And I think the error was in his strategy for this argument in particular, not in his overall strategy for getting Murphy kicked to the curb, which obviously is still in the back of his mind.
But to your point, Kenz, it does tell him something, doesn't it?
It sure does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sure does. Her reaction to this question is super telling because her primary concerns here are the investigation and doing it well, not necessarily taking into account Murphy's opinion on things, telling him all the details and when she's deciding.
Any of the details.
Any of them. Yeah. And it just feels like earlier in the book, right after the interview with the Enzers, when we were talking about Strike, asking questions, that Robin takes as testing her commitment to the job when really he's testing her commitment to Murphy.
Yeah, her reaction definitely is telling that she doesn't consider that Murphy should have any say. It reminds me of that point later on when she thinks that Strike has more rights.
Strike rights.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Here's the thing, though. If she is in a serious relationship where they love each other, even though that hasn't happened yet.
We both did air quotes at the same time.
You can't see them, but they're there.
Yeah.
I think there's an argument to be made that she should tell him the whole truth and give some consideration there, but she doesn't do that with him. But she's here doing it with Strike.
It's more evidence about how not serious she is about this guy.
Yeah. The whole thing just makes me think of later on when Strike thinks that he should have resisted more or insisted it be someone else who goes undercover. I don't know. My actual point here is that sometimes I think that Strike can't win when it comes to some people because I've seen some people say he didn't do enough in this book to protect her. Mm-hmm. Others, he's too protective, you know, in other books. Yeah. I guess it just, it makes me think that he must also find it hard to find the balance because he thinks later, I should have overruled this, right? But how can he, quote, put his foot down, so to speak, when they're partners, but also not feel guilty about not doing enough?
I think that Strike did all that he could to protect Robin in this book. I mean, you know me, I'm always going to err on the side of let Robin do what she wants, kick ass, save lives, even if it means, you know, sometimes jumping in front of trains. We've had that discussion. But honestly, I think that there's plenty that Strike can do to protect her, right? He can make smart decisions and plans about the agency. He can back her up. He can give her advice. He can argue with her until they reach an acceptable compromise. And he can do all those things while still treating her as an equal and respecting her decisions, which he does. I think he did pretty good in this book. Maybe he could have come up with some better logistical ideas for when she was undercover at the farm. There were some holes there, but you know, nobody's perfect.
Yeah, I don't know. I just remember thinking that it was a little bit different that Strike, he doesn't push at the point, right? He backs away.
Yeah, but navigating this issue imperfectly, but with love and having the whole developing argument and constant push and pull, it shows us who these people are as characters and it develops them in their relationship. It's about the story, not about having the character act in a perfectly approved way. Mm-hmm. Like, I love that they have fights about this and that neither of them are perfect and neither of them are always right and that they both screw up sometimes because that's what humans do. Right? It's what makes them real. I don't want to read a guide to acting in the correct way. Right. I want to see this person grow and develop and also screw up sometimes, you know?
Yeah, but this is definitely sort of a charged moment between them because it says that he finally broke eye contact when he goes to open a file on his computer. So they're just kind of the showdown.
Eyes locked. So whoever wins the staring contest wins the argument, right? Like those are the rules.
There's just a lot swirling in the air. Murphy having or not having rights to an opinion, her safety specifically in regards to core sex, how far Strike can push it before he's overstepping. It's a lot. It's a lot going on.
It is.
All right. Strike then suggests that they look into ex-UHC members and he brings up some important people. First person is Sherry Gittens.
Strike said that this is the only name he didn't have. Do we know why it wasn't on?
She might have missed the census, like arrived after one and then left before the next.
Yeah.
Although she would have been in any article about Dayu's death, as we learned. So he would have found her eventually.
The next person is Jordan, and we learn his last name, actually, in the next chapter.
Fun that the first two names that Strike brings up are the murder's accomplices, eh? I mean, in fact, every name he brings up here, apart from Henry, is vital to the case in some way. These are all very important names that he's listing off.
The next people that he brings up are the Doherty family. And we've talked about the troubled blood echoes in this book, but the hard no that Strike describes Ralph Doherty giving when asked for an interview is giving me shades of whenever Robin was first asking to interview Wilma Bayliss's kids in Troubled Blood.
Yeah, it does have shades of that. The other thing that stands out to me is the mention of Strike not being able to find any death records for Deirdre.
Yeah.
I don't know if we can call it a clue, but the groundwork is being laid to showed that there are unreported deaths that happen in the UHC.
And then next is Abigail Glover, who obviously is super important.
She's a bit important. Yeah, a little bit.
Not to harp on too much about the troubled blood parallels, but Robin being surprised by Abigail's career reminds me of Strike being surprised that, you know, Una had become a vicar.
I love that bit.
Yeah, it's so funny.
I like the way she's very casually introduced. Not much mystery to her. And I was also thinking she sounded pretty cool to be an actual firefighter. I guess if we're going to go full force with the troubled blood parallels, there's something there about judging someone on their profession, isn't there? Because you think nurse, firefighter, heroes.
Yeah. And when really we should have been thinking firefighter equals axe.
Not to mention the fact that the sign of the pub where they meet has an actual axe on it.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll get to that. Oh, man.
The next person that he talks about is Flora Brewster. And you know something funny? The House and Homes company that Joe talks about here is fictional as far as the iteration that's in the UK. But there is actually a construction business with that same name somewhere in British Columbia, somewhere that probably would not appreciate the quality of their work being impugned.
So is there something in these House and Homes being shoddily constructed with Flora's father bullying her, being homophobic, failing to really help her? Like, the walls crumble in the homes, and also the structure of the family is corroded.
There you go.
Am I reaching?
Maybe, but let's go with it.
All right. So the last person that he brings up is Henry Worthington Fields. And there's just something about this that feels like such a quintessential rich kid's name.
You know what? He belongs in the upper class twit of the year race, along with Nigel Incubator Jones and Gervais Brookhamster. Have you seen that skit, Kenz?
I have not, but the Incubator Jones is hilarious.
Notice I didn't even ask Lindsay if she'd seen it.
Yeah, you know better.
I know better.
I really like how Strike Finding this guy tells us how much online research he does into these people. Mm-hmm. When I worked for a PI, I did all of this kind of stuff. So I didn't do surveillance, but I did all the online investigation. And then I'd hand it off to my boss or to our subcontractors. Right. So it makes me curious if they will ever hire someone to do these kinds of things, because it does take so much work and it would free them up to take more cases, you know?
Oh, it would. Listen, talk about a good job for a young intern who needs to learn the ropes without being put into danger. I think you all know that my Jack-X Flavia dreams are fully alive and thriving.
I see that. Yeah. I do really think it could be the next step for the agency, though.
I agree. And they need a teenage intern to do it. The youths know the social media.
I guess so.
But yeah, I agree. It would be a sensible step for them to stop having to waste time on Twitter.
Right, exactly. Although it does tell us a lot as the reader, right? So maybe.
True. But think about how cute a report that Jack writes about what he found on the internet with a little Uncle Strike
in my
joke.
Head, this is not Jack happening. But yeah, they could have somebody telling. I'm sure she could work it up.
In my head, it's Jack.
I know.
And you're like, I'm in the real world.
Yeah.
Real fictional world. Because we're in the real fictional world here, not the fictional world.
Right. Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Moving on.
All right. So Robin then brings up two people who have either killed themselves or tried to kill themselves after leaving the UHC.
Yeah. So she's talking about Alexander Graves and Flora's attempt. I really feel like this and them talking about the UHC glorifying suicide is setting us up for later when we have another set like this one, where one person attempts and fails suicide, Jordan, and one succeeds, Cherie.
But then also Charlotte's successful suicide contrasted to her previous failed attempts.
Yeah.
Well, on a lighter note, we get to see the first real bits of Little John being suspicious when he shows up to the office.
This was fun and exciting, I thought. You know something suspicious is going on, because who in their right mind is coming in that weather to drop off receipts when they could just do it another day? I remember being excited about this, and I was really looking forward to figuring this whole thing out.
Yeah, I didn't figure out that it was suspicious until Strike pointed it out explicitly, because I'm very dense.
Well, Robin didn't either, so you know, you're in good company.
Well, thank God for that.
All right, next Strike gets a call from Ilsa, and as soon as Ilsa said, look, I hope you don't think I'm interfering, I immediately knew that this was going to go south quickly.
Do we agree that the real reason he's so irritated with Ilsa is because, one, he's defensive because he knows he's being an idiot, and two, he's upset about Robin's call with Murphy?
Yes to both.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
And the fact that he can hear Robin and Murphy talking at the same time. definitely is not helping. When Robin laughs at something that Murphy says for the second time, Strike thinks, the man simply couldn't be that fucking funny. I'm not sure that I've loved reading Strike's internal monologues more than I have in this book. Murphy may not be that funny, but Strike certainly is.
I'm also kind of wondering about the laughing, though, because this is pointed out a few times. It's not the first time that it says Robin's laughing at Murphy, right? And I'm just wondering if this is sort of a I need to laugh at his jokes thing.
Ooh, now that you point it out, I'm wondering the same thing, because nothing we've seen Murphy say suggests that he is particularly funny.
No, I know.
Not laugh out loud funny.
Remember the part later where Robin calls Strike and asks if he can talk, and he says he's been talking for years? I mean, of course you do. But Robin responds with a sarcastic, ha ha. You know, but I have the feeling that if Murphy had said it, Robin would have laughed for real. I don't know if this is unfair or if this is something where Robin is trying to give Murphy validation that she likes him and thinks his jokes are funny. It just, I feel like it's in here too much to be authentic.
Yeah, you know what? I could see this being the case. Didn't she think in Troubled Blood during that whole Morris nightmare at some point? Something like, why did I do that? Yes. Why did I say, haha, his joke, right?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, and she thought about how her role in the family was the easy child, keeping the peace, keeping people happy, and that she's doing it with the men in her life too. You know what? Maybe she still hasn't broken that habit, except if it's with Strike, whom she feels safe.
Exactly.
She's herself with Strike.
We also have to point out that just before Ilsa gives her full warning, Robin laughs again, and Strike goes and shuts the door between them rather more firmly than was necessary.
That narration is trying very hard to come up with a less angry version of slammed the door.
Yeah.
Narrator Strike, I'm looking at you.
What I like about this is it is a very clear nonverbal communication that neither of them acknowledge. Strike can't pretend to himself that he's mad at Robin for potentially gossiping because it hasn't even come up yet. He is sending a very clear sign that he does not want to hear her talk to her boyfriend.
I mean,
same. I don't want to hear it either.
Well, I want to hear what's so fucking funny all the time.
Cause... there's nothing, because it's not.
What do you all think Ilsa was saying to Strike before Robin walks in and hears that bit about him asking her not to interfere? Because we know from the next chapter that she's trying to warn him about the whole sperm heist thing with the married QC, right? But what is he saying, no, I don't do?
I don't think there's much time in between what we see Ilsa say, which is she's crazy, she's already told, and then he cuts her off. Because he said, you've called to give me unsolicited advice on my love life, is that right? So I would assume that Ilsa said something like, I know you don't want to hear it, or something like that.
Yeah. You know what? I think you've got that pretty much right.
Here's another what I would have done thing if I was Ilsa, given that he's being an idiot and not listening. Why just not send a text? Because then it's there in plain writing. Go straight to the point. She's told everyone at work all the details of your night together. P.S. She steals sperm from used condoms to try to get pregnant. Also, yeah. I throw in a, I'm trying to be a good friend, you absolute dickhead.
Absolutely this. Honestly, Ilsa needs some advisors to help her handle all this, because managing Strike and Robin is a full-time job, and she is a busy woman. So I think we can volunteer to draft her texts.
It seems like an easy thing to
do.
You just
did. Yeah, she just needs some help. It's a lot on her plate. She's a new mom, full-time lawyer, and a matchmaker. It's too much.
Put that on her business card.
So Strike figures out that Robin also knows about his evening with Bijou.
Yeah, I wish that he hadn't been as angry here when he realized that Robin already knew about this, because I'd really like some honest reflection from him about how this makes him feel. But the anger is clouding that. You know, I just wonder if there's any hope from him that she might be jealous, because he certainly seems to be wanting to get her back for talking to Murphy and answering the phone call from Bijou right in front of her.
Yeah, he is the literal definition of cutting off your nose to spite your face here.
Playing stupid games and winning stupid prizes.
He is indeed doing both. So is Robin, actually.
I know.
No wonder Ilsa is so exhausted.
Okay, so next up is Robin's reaction to Strike getting a call from Bijou, as it was Robin's determined habit these days not to think about her partner in any terms other than those of friendship and work. She chose to believe the mingled feelings of annoyance and hurt now possessing her were caused by Strike's irritability and the near slamming of the office door while she'd been talking to Ryan. It was entirely his business if he wanted to sleep with that vile woman again, and more fool him if he didn't realize she was after him for the fortune he didn't possess or the baby he didn't want.
I really want to know how Robin sees the door slamming. You know, did she think it was because of what Ilsa was saying? Or does she recognize that he does not want to hear her talking to Murphy?
Some part of her has got to realize that he doesn't like her dating Murphy, right?
You have to think.
He's not subtle and she's a detective. Detect this shit, Robin. Come on. Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's the name of the episode.
Detect this shit. So Strike's air of defiance at the end.
I wonder if he's almost daring Robin to say something here about Bijou so that he can throw it back at her that she's talking to Murphy in the office.
He's trying to pick a fight.
It feels like he's trying to pick a fight. You know, it's kind of the situation that has potential for a big fight about their feelings. It could have started one of those.
It really could have.
Maybe next time.
Yeah, next time.
Okay, let's go to chapter 16.
Robin and Murphy have their first fight, and Robin interviews Sheila Kennett.
The epigraph to this chapter reads, "The line at the beginning has good fortune. The second is favorable. This is due to the time. The third line bears an augury of misfortune. The fifth of illness." And that's from Hexagram 25, Innocence or the Unexpected.
I think this one should have us all excited. I think this is actually referring to two different things. So we have the story that Sheila tells us, which is terrible and sad. She tells us that things were good at first, but slowly misfortune came and finally illness with the death of Brian and just the illness that is the UHC too. Mm-hmm. But the other major thing that happens in this chapter, like you said, Kenz, is the first fight between Robin and Murphy. And I think we should all be excited because this is hinting at misfortune and illness coming, not literal, but it's describing the breakdown of something and how it goes from good to bad. Mm-hmm. I want to read the interpretation for my header deck because it feels a bit like Robin to me. It says, "Freedom from entanglement from what is not yours, such as others' problems or events that are not your responsibility, brings extraordinary energy. It liberates the natural and spontaneous creative flow and grounds you in present reality. A good time to reevaluate plans, dreams, and goals from where you are right now."
I love this interpretation, Lindsay, because I didn't know where to start with this hexagram at all. And you are very right with that header bit being about Robin. Just stop entangling yourself with this thing that's not yours, Robin. Yeah. Follow your creative
dreams. Not your problem.
He's not your problem. And on the having hope front, because eternally I do. I was reading the line judgments for this hexagram, and a few things stood out to me. In the first line, it says, "The original impulses of the heart are always good, so that we may follow them confidently, assured of good fortune and achievement." And I'm like, Robin is not following her heart's original impulse here. Mm-hmm. Doing that would be good, as the epigraph says, but she's not. So here comes the misfortune, right?
Yeah.
And then the judgment on that third line, this is bad, but the augury of misfortune made me laugh because the judgment says, "Sometimes undeserved misfortune befalls a man at the hands of another. As for instance, when someone passes by and takes the tethered cow along with him, his gain is the owner's loss." And okay, I don't want to say that this is Strike's perspective on Murphy stealing Robin away for most of this book, because obviously Robin is not Strike's cow.
Right.
But he does think of her as the prize that Murphy swooped in and stole. Sure. So, I mean,
no, it works. It's fine.
It's misfortune. Yeah. I'm not saying Robin's a cow.
She's no, we know.
Cow. So, and just to quickly share one more line judgment for this hexagram that isn't mentioned in the epigraph, just for my own amusement. It says, "We cannot lose what really belongs to us, even if we throw it away. Therefore, we need have no anxiety." Am I crazy for feeling like this means that Strike is Robin's? Even if she's messing around with Murphy here, she's not going to lose Strike because he belongs to her. So we don't need to be anxious. We don't need to worry about what Murphy's going to do.
Yeah.
Because Strike is Robin's.
Of course.
And Robin is Strike's.
I agree.
Okay. So it mentions at the beginning of this chapter that Strike and Robin are communicating only through texts and only matter of fact ones. And there's no jokes or extraneous chat, which tells us that there typically is that, right?
Yeah.
Now, is it weird that I kind of want to read what jokes and other chat they squeeze in while talking about work stuff? Because I really do.
No, it's not weird. We all love that kind of thing because it shows all the corners of their relationship and fills in the gaps of things we don't get to see that much of their relationship outside of work. Not that we don't see any of it, but it's nice to know that this is something that actually happens normally.
Yeah, I agree. It's totally implied that they normally chat and joke over text. I'm going to need complete transcripts of that. Just like you, Kenz. That's not weird. I think someone needs to call their cell network. Tell them I have a warrant.
Yeah.
It's called I Want to Read It.
I'm sure that they'll accept that. A judge will sign off on that.
It says I can do what I want.
Robin was more annoyed with herself for dwelling on the door slamming and the accusation that she'd been gossiping with Ilsa behind her partner's back than she was at Strike for doing either of these two things.
I mean, at this point, I tend to agree with Robin that I too am mostly irritated with her for ignoring what's right in front of her. Rather than Strike being an idiot here.
Honestly, I'm ready to smack both of them upside the head. They're driving me crazy. I generally could not pick a winner in the drive pools insane contest. Mm-hmm. It's a tie for first.
Yeah.
You know, photograph finish. They're both really nailing it.
They are. Mm. Yeah. Strike knowing that he was wrong and was unreasonable but not apologizing reminds me so much of that part in Harry Potter when someone, I think it's Dumbledore, said that it's harder for people to forgive someone for being right than it is to forgive them for being wrong. Does that ring a bell? I think it's about Percy.
Yeah, that does seem familiar, and I think it was about Percy.
But that's exactly what Strike is doing here.
Mm-hmm.
It was such a relief to read Strike saying that he knew he was making a mistake within 5 minutes of meeting her again.
Oh my God, I know.
It was like, oh, thank God. They're like, yeah, this is not going to go on for much longer. Thank God. The picture that Joe paints here of Bijou just yammering on and on and on and on and on about the QCs who like her and Strike just sitting there in silence is so vivid.
I'd be very interested to know if Bijou has any close friends because I just can't imagine many people putting up with that kind of behavior.
It is pretty obnoxious.
Yeah, I'm guessing that any friends she has are just as nutty as she is.
Oh, God.
You know, birds of a feather. Lots of crazy ass birds out there. Walking around.
Yeah, just squawking all over the place.
Squawking all over. with their fake bird boobs and their tiny bird sizes.
Badly wired lamps anonymous.
Oh, man.
And the best part here is reading about his self-disgust, because that is a marked change.
Yeah, the full line is, determined at least to get what he'd come for, he left her flat a few hours later with a faint feeling of self-disgust and a strong desire never to set eyes on her again.
Same on that last one.
Yeah, me too. I had a lot of feelings going on with this line, because the part about being determined to get what he came for is not the best Strike moment for me. You know, we've talked about our favorite Strike moments before. This would go on my least favorite. Mm-hmm. But yes, it is slightly redeemed with him feeling that self-disgust. And that is an important change.
Yeah, this is my least favorite Strike as well. It's not a good look.
No.
But at least T-Rex recognizes that it was wrong after the fact. I don't know. He's right to feel disgusted with himself because it's gross behavior. He's better than this.
It would be worse if he said it and didn't recognize and didn't have that self-disgust. That's why this is a little bit redeemable, because he does recognize it so quickly. But not my favorite.
While it was hardly the first time Strike had slept with a woman he wasn't in love with, never before had he screwed someone he actively disliked. The whole episode, which he now considered firmly closed, had intensified rather than alleviated his low mood, forcing him back up against his feelings for Robin.
Yeah, I really hope this tiny little thing about not being the first time he had slept with a woman he wasn't in love with will come back, because I think we know for certain that he has never slept with a woman for the first time while already being in love with that woman, right? And I want to hear all about it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Extra read all about it. That's what I want.
I mean, exactly. And meanwhile, Robin has now spent literal years pretending to be in love with the two different men she's been sleeping with, all told. When was the last time she was genuinely in love with the man she was sleeping with? Not since, like, before Career of Evil, because I think she'd fallen out of love with Matthew by
then. Doesn't she say it was before, around the rape, she was falling out of love with him?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, she was falling out of love with him, though. Okay, so, Jesus. Long-ass time. My point is that I think this is going to be absolutely mind-blowing for both of them.
Again, really want to read it.
Same.
But that last line, that this is forcing him back up against his feelings for Robin.
It's like he's being forced back up against the ropes in a boxing ring, you know? Like, there's no way he can turn his thoughts to avoid looking at what he feels for Robin again, because he's so miserable and lonely and self-loathing. Mm-hmm. There's literally nowhere else he can think.
We learn that Robin and Murphy have had their first fight.
It's kind of a long time into a relationship to have had a first fight. Mm-hmm. Tells me that there's not a lot of real stuff going on there.
It's the question, do you not fight because you don't disagree on things, or because it's not worth the effort? And for me, Robin is very much coasting along in relationships, not bothering to fight because the relationship itself isn't worth the effort of resolving conflicts. Until, of course, it comes to her defending her work and her relationship with Strike.
Or if it is her relationship with Strike. She very much fights in that one.
She fights in that one, and she'll fight with other people for her work and for Strike, but mm-hmm. anything else, it's just not worth the effort for her.
Yeah.
And it's a red flag.
The fight between them happens because Murphy was under the impression that she was just going into the cult for 7 days, that she would just be going for the retreat part, but not staying. I know Robin's good, but did he expect her to bring down an entire cult in 7 days?
Yeah.
From the line that says Murphy was nettled that Robin hadn't explained the situation fully, while Robin was irate at the fact that he hadn't listened properly.
I'm torn because I can see Murphy not listening, but I can also see Robin describing the job in slightly vague terms to avoid the fight. But if she had done that, I think she'd have been fully aware that she was doing it. So I'm going to blame Murphy for this one. Open your ears, bud.
That's interesting because she does not say the thing about the spirit bonding, right? But she's also very honest with herself sometimes about what she does.
I think she knows when she's doing this. Mm-hmm. And if she didn't know that she was doing it, then I think it's Murphy's fault.
That's fair.
It might not be Murphy's fault that he was bringing back unpleasant memories of her ex-husband's assumed right to dictate the limits of her professional commitment, but the comparison was unavoidable, given that Murphy seemed to think Strike had pressured Robin into doing this onerous job, and she hadn't been assertive enough to refuse.
We're only at chapter 16 of a 136 chapter book, and this is already the second time that this man has reminded her of her ex-husband. I mean, Robin, take a hint.
That's a massive red flag.
It's not a good sign for their relationship, I'll tell you that.
It's not necessarily a thing against Murphy, but for their relationship, it's a bad thing.
Exactly.
The thing that I think is actually really funny about this, though, is it says that it might not be Murphy's fault. And you know what? I don't think it is. It's Robin's, because like you said, Poole, she is not addressing the actual problem. And she's trying to have another serious relationship while she's still in love with Strike.
Exactly. Robin needs to cut this guy loose. Throw the whole man fish back so that he can go find some other lady fish who will lay eggs for him. You know, he's got a whole ocean. He'll find someone, and Robin needs to be a more responsible fisherwoman.
Extend that metaphor.
I'll take that metaphor as far as I possibly can. Absolutely.
It really irked me when it said that Murphy seemed to think that Strike had pressured Robin to take the job and that she hadn't been strong enough to say no. And I was about to say, does he not know Robin? But I guess the truth is that he doesn't. He doesn't know that, one, she'd want the job, and that, two, she certainly has no problem arguing with Strike.
Exactly. None. This is the same conclusion that Linda also jumps to all the time, that the job is Strike's fault, that Robin couldn't possibly be the driving force behind her own career because it's such a dangerous, you know, workaholic kind of situation. Linda, I think, will come around eventually, like we talked about. But Murphy, I mean, it doesn't matter if he could or would figure it out. He's on borrowed time anyways. So,
well, I wonder if they come to this conclusion because she doesn't ever fight with them.
Oh, I think so.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, she's getting better at that with Linda, but that's probably where this is coming from.
Yeah.
I really don't like Murphy's response of, and he's going to miss you. Is that what you're saying? No matter how true it may actually be.
Very true.
I was kind of the opposite. I liked this very much. So I was like, keep going, Murphy. Would you like me to hand you the shovel so you could dig your own hole there, buddy?
Mm-hmm.
There you go.
Yeah,
I liked it. And I liked Robin being forced with the idea that Strike is going to miss her.
Mm-hmm. Murphy's apology being within sight of where Matthew proposed. I mean, come on. She is being really, really heavy-handed with these Matthew comparisons. Like, they're being drawn for a reason.
Yeah, it's very intentional. I know that a lot of people are worried that Murphy is going to propose, but even if he does, I can't see Robin accepting after what she says about marrying Matthew being such a mistake and all of the reminders of him in this relationship. That ending is such a huge thing for me when she says
really
that at the end.
Mm-hmm. I am with the team Murphy's going to propose. I too can't believe that Robin would say yes at this point after what happens at the end of this book. But, you know, I also couldn't believe many other things that Robin and Carmen have ended up actually doing. So I'm a little bit afraid.
I seriously think that this is a big setup for her following her heart and choosing the alternative this time, as opposed to career of evil.
Oh, I hope so.
I do. I think it has to happen. Mm-hmm. There's not enough books left.
There isn't. They got to stop messing around.
Yeah.
They really do need to get on this. And by this, I mean each other.
Robin is still in a low mood the next morning because she is again finding it difficult to reconcile her work life from her personal life. It also makes me think of that line in Silkworm where Robin's trying to force these two halves of her life into one.
Yeah.
Remember that bit? What's the line?
She wanted to tug the working life that she had never enjoyed so much closer to the personal life that currently refused to meld with it. She wanted to stitch the two together in a satisfying whole. And to see Strike in the congregation approving. Approving? Why did he have to approve of her marrying Matthew?
I remember reading that and going, huh, because I wasn't really a shipper then back in, you know, when Silver came out. But with lines like that, no one can say that they didn't see it coming.
Yeah, you know? I wasn't really invested in shipping it at the time either. But even so, when Robin said this, I was like, oh, sweetheart, baby girls, sweet, precious summer child. That's not going to happen.
Next, Robin gets a call from Ilsa.
Yeah, I want to know why Ilsa says that Nick thinks that she should apologize. Why? Is Nick just trying to keep the peace or is he also being stupid? I don't. Why
would he's a man, isn't he? I'm joking. Couldn't resist. But I'm guessing that, yeah, Nick's on the side of keeping the peace and probably much more on the side of that's his business. We should stay out of it, which is kind of typical man behavior, really, in my experience.
Okay, this next bit made me laugh a lot. Ilsa, said Robin, cutting across her friend, if you're about to ask me whether I quiz Strike on his contraceptive habits.
Yeah, this question about Strike's contraceptive habits, I think the three of us have agreed that we think Strike would be very careful with that, right? Because he's he very clearly doesn't want children. And given that he's 41 and doesn't have any, I think we can conclude that that's true.
Yeah, agreed. But I still think that Robin really should take one for the team and quiz him on it, just so we can know for sure. And also for our own entertainment.
Right. But, and I have to give credit to Katie for this, because she pointed out that later in this chapter, Sheila Kennett calls him Condom Man Strike, which is the most creative of all the mispronunciations of his name, right?
It really is.
But Katie argued, and I agree with her, that this has to be a direct answer to this question. He is very likely a condom man, I think, which sounds like a terrible superhero. You know? Or maybe it's good. I don't know. Condom man. He shows up when you need one. You know? He floats down on a parachute that's just a giant condom.
You know what? Truly the hero that we deserve.
But yeah, I do think that this was a bit of a nod towards that.
So Ilsa talks about Bijou's sperm heist.
I still do not understand why Ilsa just doesn't text him exactly that. I get that she doesn't want to make him mad, but at this point, who cares? Is making him mad really worse than the thing that they're worried about happening?
Right? Like, fuck that. I'd text him too. And my text would be liberally sprinkled with phrases like, you idiot and fucking moron. Yeah. I'd go full paragraph on him for this.
I would rather my friend be mad at me for not minding my own business than not telling them that the woman they're sleeping with is a semen heister. Is that a word? I don't know. But you know what I mean.
I believe that spurgler is acceptable in this context. But I'm pretty sure that heister could be a word. So either way, we're good. Yeah.
But you know what I mean? I know it's all adding to the tension for us. Mm-hmm. But my God, they should have told him. It's no wonder, though, after all this, that Robin is feeling even more miserable, because I think however much she doesn't want to admit it, Strike sleeping with someone else is still really painful for her. Not to mention the worry that she must now feel about Bijou being a semen heister.
Yeah, the thought of him sleeping with someone else, the thought of him having a child with someone else, let alone with a random horrible, horrible woman, it would be torture for her.
It would.
I mean, it'd be like Strike worrying about her being pregnant with Matthew's child and Lethal White.
All right, so Robin arrives at Sheila Kennett's place.
Yeah, I have to point out something that I love, and I have a feeling Pools, you know exactly what I'm going to say. When Robin introduces herself to Sheila, she shows her her driver's license.
Yes, I love
it. So I know. We've talked about this before, how this is a thing that Strike does that we liked because it always shows him doing this, especially when it comes to women who live alone. Mm-hmm. We see him do this with the Quine's neighbor and with Lang's ex in Career of Evil, right?
Yeah.
I just love seeing that Robin is doing it too.
Me too. It's a perfect little moment that shows us the fact that they've been working together for 6 years, that Strike has trained her in detective stuff, that they've picked up on each other's habits and traits such that they're moving closer together to, I assume, eventually literally become the same person, because they're basically already there. But yeah, I did like this. You were right.
I love this description of the picture of Sheila and her husband, Brian, where it says, the picture was made touching by the fact that the slightly goofy looking Brian was beaming as though he couldn't believe his luck. This is so sweet.
It is sweet. It makes me sad to think about what happened to them and him.
Also, you can't tell me that that's not going to be Strike whenever he and Robin get married.
Totally not believing his luck.
Aww. I can't remember when or why, but I swear we talked about wedding pictures before in the series when we saw them.
In Troubled Blood?
Does that sound familiar to anyone? Because I think there was one at the Bristows, and then there's the one with the Chisels, Izzy's parents, you know? Mm. I don't remember what we were saying, but I know we were connecting this to Strike and Robin, as we do.
Yeah, I can't remember this either. I bet one of our listeners would remember.
Yeah, if you remember what we said. Let us know, because we can add this to the list of wedding pictures that we're seeing. First, I need to know what we said, and then we could decide if it fits.
Right.
But it does sound familiar.
Yeah, vaguely.
This might be a random question, but have we ever found out exactly how Robin takes her tea? Because she tells Sheila here that she doesn't take sugar, and she could be lying, so she doesn't trouble Sheila any further. But I'm wondering if this is the first time we're hearing.
Yeah, we've never actually found out how she takes her tea, which has been a sore spot for a long time.
Yeah.
But I do kind of believe that she was lying here to avoid making Sheila go back in the kitchen.
I could totally see that. Yeah.
But was it a lie that aligned with truth? I don't know.
We need to know.
So then Sheila starts to talk about the beginning of her and Brian's time at Chapman Farm in 1969.
So she was there for a long time. If she started in 69, right? And then she remembered Strike being there.
Yeah. So Strike would have been in 85. So they would have spent 16 or 17 years there in the first chunk. And then after they left, when it got raided, gone back by 1990 when Mazu and Waste took charge and needed farmers. And then she would have left after Brian's death, which sounds like it was not too long after Dyer's drowning. This is all stuff for the timeline. So that's like 25 years total around there.
Also, just to point out, this doesn't mean anything, but the Manson family was also around the time, the late 60s, the hippies, and the murders took place in 69. So that all kind of fits together.
Yeah, it was very much the hippie era.
This mention of Mazu's mother, Anne, giving birth to her at 14 is giving me big shades of the FLDS.
It's really sad, and also a bit of foreshadowing for Robin also having to do the exact same thing, help someone give birth.
Oh, yeah.
I wonder if Mazu's interest or obsession in Chinese culture came from her mother giving her the name Mazu and maybe wanting to connect with her in some way.
Mm.
I looked it up on Wikipedia. It says that Mazu is a Chinese sea goddess. Hmm. Mazu was traditionally thought to roam the seas, protecting her believers through miraculous interventions.
I am so curious as to why this 14-year-old girl in the late 60s, 70s chose the name Mazu for her daughter. Yeah. How would she even know about this name with no connection to China or Chinese culture? Because, like, there's no Google. Mm-hmm. I mean, was Malcolm Crowther really into Eastern mysticism and preached about it to this young girl?
Maybe.
Like you said, it does seem likely that Mazu's obsession with Chinese culture comes from her name, maybe as a way to connect with her mother, or maybe as a way to make herself seem special and mysterious to other people, like a form of power.
Yeah, it is kind of fascinating, you know, her interest in this and how she lies to people that she's half Chinese.
Yeah.
It's a very strange thing to lie about, although I know people do it.
They sure do.
Anyway, Sheila tells Robin that they left after everything came out about the pedophilia, and I just feel so sad that they went back.
Next, Sheila talks about Jonathan Wace, Mazu, and Abigail starting out at Chapman Farm, and she says, "I felt sorry for Abigail. Her mom died, then her dad brought her to the farm, and next minute she's got a sister."
So the first eyewitness account of Abigail that we get primes us to feel sympathetic to her. So combine that with the hero job, none of us are going to guess that she's the murderer.
Which should have made us guess that she was the murderer.
Exactly. Fool me again.
I know. I notice here that when Sheila tells the story of Rusty Anderson's death, that Wace says that this was his judgment for all the lives he took in war, which is interesting because he didn't mention that bit at the UHC meeting.
At all.
Didn't. He seems to have changed up the moral of the story.
Sure did.
Or maybe there's a version of it that he tells publicly to tug on the heartstrings and draw on the recruits. And then there's a different version that the members eventually learn that's designed to keep them in line.
This next bit that I'm about to read reminds me a bunch of the Q&A question we did, I think it was a couple episodes ago, where we were talking about Jonathan Wace. And Sheila says, "Jonathan had a way of making you believe, a way of making you want to make everything all right for him. You wanted to look after him."
To me, this is how Wace is such a good manipulator, using guilt, the way he makes people feel sorry for his pain and make them need to take care of him. You know, it's incredibly manipulative.
Yeah.
Especially because I don't believe he's ever really in emotional pain.
Yeah, no, I don't think Wace feels an an ounce of empathy for other human beings. This is all crocodile tears.
Next, we learn about Mazu and replenishments, and we hear mention of Paul Draper, which that whole story is heartbreaking. And then we also learn Jordan Rini's last name.
I can't believe that this, what we learn here, that's horrible enough, is only the tip of the iceberg of tragic and terrible that is Paul's story. I'm not looking forward to rereading some of those bits. I'm not going to lie. It's not pleasant.
Is this the first time Robin's really learning about punishments, though? I know this was a long time ago, so it might not seem as worrysome, but I was certainly worried.
I mean, she'll have read Kevin mentioning punishments in his emails to Sir Colin, but he didn't go into the specifics beyond being tied to a tree, which, horrible enough.
Right.
If I were Robin, the whippings and something worse that Sheila won't even say, that would have been giving me pause.
Yeah, of course.
It really would have been.
When Sheila talks about the atmosphere on the farm after Dayu died and then the punishments for those involved, especially Brian, man, that was so chilling.
It's interesting that she talks about all of them who were involved with Dayu's death, because it does end up being a group effort, a group collaboration.
Teamwork.
A murder collaboration.
Teamwork makes the dream work.
But not in the way that's being described here, right? It's a bit of a clue. It's also funny the way Sheila describes Abigail as little Abigail, because it gives us a real impression of innocence to me. And I know she probably is saying it because she was younger than she was. We all do that, right? Oh, that kid over there, and they're like 23 or something. But to me, this is just a misdirection that kind of settles in your brain and makes you think that Abigail was a victim.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. None of us were thinking like 15, 16 years old when she said little.
Of course.
None of us.
Yeah.
But she was.
We hear from Sheila how the UHC tried to dissuade her from leaving, and then Jonathan Wace's rationalization of Brian's death, which is really gross.
It's really gross. It's really evil.
What a piece of shit.
Yeah. You know what? I'm hoping, Sheila, we'll get some consolation from seeing Wace and the UHC brought down. Again, that theme, justice heals.
Healing for everyone, please. You get healing, you get healing.
And she gets healing. Everyone gets some
all
healing.
Around. Yeah.
Sheila seemed exhausted. Robin, who didn't want to leave her in this state, turned the conversation gently to cats and their vagrant habits.
I can't believe that after all of the shit that this woman's gone through, her poor cat was run over outside her house. It's just not fair. It's not right. I don't accept it.
The cherry on top of this interview is Sheila blaming Sherry for Dayu's death.
I think what she's really angry about here is that in her mind, the cruelty happening at the farm really amped up after Dayu's death with the punishments and those sort of things. Mm-hmm. And I bet she thinks that if that hadn't happened, Brian might have been allowed to get help and maybe he wouldn't have died. So I think that's what she means by it was all her fault.
Yeah.
I think she might be blaming Brian's death on Sheree.
I think you're right. She's holding this point of Dayu's death as the point where it all went wrong, right?
Yeah.
And she needs someone to blame for that other than Wace. She calls Wace wicked, but she seems angrier at Sheree. Is this another instance of blaming a woman for triggering a man's actions? Wace is the wicked one, but Sherry's the one responsible because she made the whole thing go wrong?
Maybe. Sheree was the one who took Dayu, so it's because of that everything changed.
Chain of events, yeah.
And then her parting wish for Robin is to stop the UHC. I have to imagine that after everything happens, Robin calls Sheila up and went for another visit to tell her everything. Mm-hmm. I mean, that has to have happened.
It is absolutely my headcanon. So that means, yes, it does happen in my fictional world. But in that meeting, Sheila would have been very pleased to see that Robin's hair was no longer blue.
Yeah.
That would have been the highlight for her. He's like, oh, thank God you're wearing your hair normally like a pretty young woman should.
Yeah. You know, I just feel like Robin would understand that justice would be healing for Sheila, just like it is for her, you know. Yeah. She would want to go tell her.
She absolutely would. Robin gets it.
Okay, so what are we doing on our next episode?
We are doing chapters 17 through 19 for next episode. Mm-hmm. And in 17 through 19, we get the interview with Henry Worthington Fields, and then Charlotte meets up with Strike. I think this is the first and last time we see her in person in this book.
Forever. Yeah. Not just in the book, for forever.
Just hands.
And then in chapter 19, we see Robin getting recruited to the UHC.
Oh man, we're at a big turning point, aren't we?
Uh-huh. Yep. Can't wait.
That'll do it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoy what you've heard, don't forget to follow us on social media. We're on Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr at the SE Files Pod. You can also contact us on our website at thesefilespod.com.
or email us directly at sefilespodcast@gmail.com. Thank you so much again for listening, and we hope to catch you next time for another episode of the Strike and Ellicott Files.